seriously on how the institution was perceived.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the curricular changes that were instituted, and also some of the administration of the university. It was certainly a time of transition in terms as far as the curriculum goes. And obviously the semester transition or transition from terms to semester occurred under your administration.
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about some of those the acronym programs, or if you remember any of those? Or?
Sure. Well, I was, when I got there, I thought, gee, the quarter system has certain advantages. Students take fewer courses, can concentrate on those courses, and maintain at least to a degree the information that they had received during the course more fully, and perhaps when they took an examination, therefore be able to do a bit better. And it seemed like a model that would be interesting and have certain advantages. However, when I got there and I began to talk to students, I discovered that what had happened was that while the model was initially to take fewer courses 3, 3, and 4, now because of the way the curriculum had become structured, students were taking 4 and having to take 4 every quarter in order to finish a normal course. And I thought, wow, this mitigates against what the purpose was. In fact, our students are being disadvantaged because they're being asked to do more than students at other institutions. And therefore, perhaps their grade points won't be competitive if they want to go on to graduate professional study or even to get employment. And I thought this was very disturbing to me. And secondly, because we were on the quarter system, our schedule didn't correlate with anybody else's schedule, so there was no potential for us to have any cross-fertilization. And I saw some opportunities for that, although don't know if they ever came about. I said, well, gee, why should we all have everything? I mean, we had the premier African Studies Center in the country, and Michigan had the premier Asian Studies Center in the country. And I said, well, why don't we just allow students to take courses at either place in those disciplines? It was interesting to me that, while I said that publicly a number of times, Jim Duderstadt at Michigan, sometime thereafter, said, we have to develop an African Studies Center here because Michigan State has one, you know? It was bizarre, you know, because it was an opportunity for us to share and to use our resources more wisely. Excuse me. Well, when I discussed this with a few people, Lee Winder, who had been provost there, and some others, I said, you know, maybe we ought to. He said, well, you know, the faculty's considered this several times, and they've always rejected the idea. So I said, well, you know, is it possible for us to float it again? Oh, yeah, we can float it again. So we went to, what's it called there, Academic Council. And, you know, which is made up of students, faculty, and administrators. And I presented it to them, and there was a lot of discussion and dialogue. And they had two possibilities. They could pass it, or they could refer it to the Faculty Senate, which was the whole faculty, for consideration. Now, they couldn't vote it up or down. They could just refer it back for clarification or for addition or whatever. So that's what they did. And they went down to the Faculty Senate, and they made a bunch of suggestions, and there was a lot of debate over it. And now it came back, and now the council voted it again. And now it went back to the Senate again. And it was a huge meeting. I'll never forget. The auditorium was packed with people, almost 800 people, and that's a significant number.
I was there.
Yeah, remember? And there was a lot of discussion, dialogue, debate. And then I remember Walter Adams stood up and said, enough. We've talked about this enough. Now call the question. The question was called. Somebody got up and said, I move that we do this by secret ballot. So they said, okay, we'll do it by secret ballot. Now, you've got to imagine the piles of paper that were up on this table. And I'm sitting there thinking, dear God, don't let there be a tie, because I will have to. And the thing, this is a true story, the thing passed, 400 to 399.
That's right.
A real mandate, right? 400 to 399, nobody contested it, it was all over, and we were on the semester system. I might add parenthetically, that's one of my three really extraordinary accomplishments at Michigan State. I mean, you have to build a monument to me someday, and you have to etch these three things in it. The other two are this. When I first got there, I was going to my first meeting of the council, walking across campus with Lee Winter, and I said, what are we discussing, Lee, today? A dismissal for cause document. Under what circumstances we can dismiss a tenured faculty member? Ooh, I said, that's an interesting subject. So we get over there, and oh, there are amendments offered and discussion and amendments. And finally, there's a pause. And, you know, I do what I thought was a thing to do, you know, what I would have expected to do. I said, well, gee, apparently, since there are no other amendments being offered, we return to the original motion and we vote. And we voted. And it barely passed, but it passed. And there was this stunned silence. And I turned to the secretary, who had been there for the millennium, you know, and I said, well, what's the matter? Well, we voted. I said, yes. And we passed it. I said, yes. He said, well, we've been discussing it for some time. I said, oh, how long? 17 years. 17 years. I said, oh, my God. Little did I know. Then they had a document which was a grievance document that had been the interim grievance document for 10 years. And I got it finally made a permanent document. So those are three really remarkable accomplishments, right?
Absolutely. Within academia, it is.
Well, isn't that an amazing story?
Yes.
It's a true story.
How
I mean,
slowly they move. Get them off the deck.
At any rate, there were a lot of curriculum discussions, but you know, I'm of the opinion, you didn't really ask me, my administrative style is to delegate responsibility and authority and to hold people accountable. You know, and that's the way I manage. And the curriculum belongs to the faculty. It doesn't belong to the administration. And, you know, I felt I could have input, you know, I could discuss, you know, give my view, but that in the final analysis, that decision had to be made by the faculty and not by the administration. And that's the way it really happened in most instances, I think. Sometimes people felt that, you know, David Scott pressed a little too hard on his interests and issues, but fundamentally the faculty did have control over curriculum. And I had a number of administrative officers to whom I delegated responsibility and authority and then held them accountable and trusted their judgment.
Would you talk a little bit about your people that were working closely with you in the administration? David
yeah.
Scott, you mentioned.
Yeah, well, Lee, you know, retired a year or two after I got there, and then a search committee identified David as a candidate. I mean, recommended him to me. Roger Wilkinson was acting vice president for finance administration, so I made him permanent vice president. It was one of the first times that the trustees intruded because they wanted to me to appoint somebody from the state that they had as a candidate. And I said I didn't see any reason for doing that if there was somebody competent with inside who had worked for the university for some years. The vice president of student affairs was already in place, and I saw no reason to change that. We had a vice president of public relations at the time. She left shortly thereafter, moved to Atlanta, and we Terry acted in the role for a period of time, and then we made him permanent. I changed the legal structure. There was an attorney who was the only sole university attorney, and he was actually in practice
Lee Carr.
Lee Carr. Strange man, but really a very decent man. But peculiar in his behavior, you know. But he was ill too, and you know, he boasted that they had never lost a case, and that's probably the case. But you know, the university wasn't as complex as it now had become, And I felt that they needed, you know, we needed more representation than that. So we created a vice presidency for legal affairs and a staff, which I thought was necessary with expertise in the various areas of the university. Because there were so many things now, there were so many litigious actions that we were encountering that, you know, we felt we had to have something different than that. I also took they had a secretary of the Board of Trustees, and that person retired too, and I
thought, Jack Breslin, or no, that was Ballard, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was before that, yeah, not Jack. Oh. Jack was in place, he was in governmental affairs.
Was it Kissinger who was?
Oh, I don't remember the guy's name. But we made the person that was my executive also the secretary of the board and with a staff, and that worked out, I think, much better than having the two offices separate. You know, for efficiency as well as for just control, I think. And then Jack was there, of course, and I went through his tragedy with him and his family and eulogized him as well. But, you know, he was doing governmental affairs and doing that really quite well. He really had a good relationship with many people down in the legislature, and that was helpful to us. At least, you know, they were generous to us in terms of capital projects. You know, one-time things. I mean, God sakes, they built that veterinary clinical building and while I was there, and we built the Breslin Center and lots of other things that we built while I was there, and that was all grand. But what they didn't give us was money to sustain ourselves. Operating monies and monies for salaries and things that I thought were more critical than the buildings. But they were always prepared to give you money for buildings for some reason or other.
Still continues to this day.
Yeah.
In working with David Scott, how would you characterize him as his provost?
Yeah, well, David's a very bright guy, and he had lots of wonderful ideas. He developed a large cadre of staff people that, you know, that he would consult with, and so he'd have a large dean's council, a huge group to attend. Don't know how he could say grace over that many. My view was always I could only, you know, there's only so many could report to me and that I could really keep track of. But that was his style. He wanted a lot of participation, but he was also very committed to diversity. You know, very committed to the land grant concept. I mean, just, you know, absolutely dedicated to the institution, really following through on its mission. And could be forceful in that regard. And sometimes, you know, people got angry with him because of that. But, you know, an excellent person with all the right motives and attitudes, you know. I always sometimes had to work with him on style more than on, you know, where his heart was. His heart was in the right place. But he alienated some folks in the process. But I helped him when he wanted to come here to UMass. Would have helped him anywhere. Because I did respect his, and he's done a very good job here.
Your continuing relationship with the board. How would you, we were talking a little bit about that, some of the members that you worked with, and the dynamics.
Well, there were board members, you know, that I had extraordinarily close relationships with. Dee Cook and I had gone to high school together. She went to Detroit Denby as well. We were graduated in the same class. Dolores Myers in those days, but you know, I was delighted to rekindle that relationship. Pat Wilson was on the board then. He was a wonderful man. Pat had played football at Michigan State and was a lawyer from Traverse City, a very decent, good man that I was very close to. Dean Pridgen was just a wonderful person, very quiet, very unassuming, you know, a hog farmer, but, you know, really attuned to what Michigan State was really all about. Barbara Sawyer was a member of the board when I came there, and she was very supportive and very helpful. chairman at the time when I came was an African American, wonderful man. Father was an Episcopal priest in Detroit. You know, can you help me kind of think of that?
I'm trying very hard to think of it too. Darn.
It wasn't meant to be a memory test.
Yeah, we can fill that in.
Fill that in.
Yeah, we will.
Because he's just a wonderful person. And they were all good people. I mean, you know, they were good people. I had a conflict with a couple because I didn't think, you know, their attitudes were appropriate. That they were very intrusive. They were more interested in intercollegiate athletics and where their seats were than what was happening with the university. And two of them are still there, I think. And that was a problem. And you know, when I got there, I mean, they weren't on the board then, either one of them. In fact, there was quite a bit of change when I got there. You know, I had the endorsement of the entire board. You know, that's one of the problems there. You know, your board members change. The board is so small. You know, it's only 8 people. It's a slight change has a dramatic impact. You know, at Michigan, I'm told that when they had 4 Republicans, 4 Democrats, they were always in conflict with one another. You know, always trying to outdo one another, and the president's caught in between the two groups and trying to keep them all happy. But I didn't think it was political at Michigan State. It was individual. On either party, there were good people, and there were some who, you know, with whom I took exception.
President Horton constantly experienced a 5-3 split in the ratio. Did you have any type of similar?
Yeah, in fact, you know, he only got appointed, I understand, because Blanche voted with the Republicans to appoint him.
That's correct.
And you know, so he came in with a split vote, and it was difficult. I didn't come in with that. I came in with a unanimous vote, but it didn't make much difference when the board changed its, you know, in character.
The role of intercollegiate athletics at the Land-Grant Institution obviously was a key one that developed during your administration. Would you talk a little bit about what circumstances there, the relationship with Coach Perlis and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, John Hanna used athletics to bring Michigan State into prominence. I mean, he recognized that he had to do something to get people to appreciate, you know, that Michigan State was equivalent to any Big Ten institution. And the vehicle for doing that was to get Michigan State into the Big Ten. They were playing teams equivalent to Big Ten teams prior to that time. But he had to find a way to convince the Big Ten that they ought to accept them as a member, at the same time to get the legislature to approve changing their status from Michigan State College to Michigan State University. And from his perspective, you know, athletics was the way, one way of doing that. So what he did was he, and this is a true story because they became so familiar with all of this, he went to the president of Notre Dame and he said, if you will play us, sign a long-term contract to play us annually, we will take less of the gate, 25% rather than 50. And that will give us the credibility so that the Big Ten will not be able to deny us admission. Well, Father Kavanaugh, if I'm not correct at the time, said, you know, John, we will play you, but we'll split the gate just like we always do. And indeed, getting that, you know, embarrassed the Big Ten, because here they were playing one of the major schools in the country every year. at least from what I'm told, to accept Michigan State. And at the same time, of course, he was working through the legislature. And remember now, it's rural, and he's got a lot of friends. And despite the fact that Harlan Hatcher worked vigorously to try to get the, oh, and by the way, the vote was very close, to put them like 5-4 or whatever it was, 5-3, 5-4. And Michigan voted against Michigan State coming into the Big Ten. And then Harlan Hatcher worked very hard to keep them out of, keep them from becoming a university. He traveled all around the state, and when the vote came down, there was one senator that voted against Michigan State becoming a university. I don't know if you know this history, but this is the reality.
But that was the second vote. The first time they actually were able to defeat it, and then they came back again the following year.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they got it.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I'm just.
But that's very
lore, what I'm told.
And it's also correct about Notre Dame.
Yeah. Well, you know, I must tell you, when Father Hesburgh was retiring, along with Ned Joyce, Ned Joyce came over for a game, and we gave him a blanket, a Michigan State blanket, and I've talked about this, and how wonderful Notre Dame had been to us. And he said, yeah, you guys are really grateful. For the next 16 years, you beat us 15 times or something. You know, that was those were the great Michigan State years, right? You know, right up to 66, you know, we were... Well, at any rate, unfortunately, you know, there were a lot of corners cut, too, you know. And I'm not sure that John was even totally familiar or privy to them, although I think in a way he just sort of ignored them. And some stuff was going on, and it continued to go on until during Cliff Wharton's time there was an NCAA investigation, which was a bit embarrassing for the university. And there was a lot of shenanigans, Cliff says, that were going on. By the time I arrived there, that was all set aside. I was, you know, as a member of the Knight Commission, as a person who has an interest in intercollegiate athletics, you should understand that I am a supporter of intercollegiate athletics. I think it's good for the kids who participate because they have a special skill. You know, it's good for those of us who are fans because we enjoy watching it, whether we be on the campus or off, and it's good for campus spirit, morale. It isn't intercollegiate athletics that's bad, it's what's happened with it. It's gotten, you know, out of hand. I mean, we admitted some students that I was aware of at Michigan State who were very marginal. And even more importantly, we didn't do anything to add value to them. I mean, I knew story after story of students who were there who didn't really take genuine courses, who didn't earn genuine degrees, who were exploited, in essence, as athletes. And that was disturbing to me. And I kept asking about this. I mean, you know, why does this have to be? I mean, we want to maintain, and sure, there should be some give, just as we have some give for students who are gifted in other ways, who are musicians or artists. Maybe they can't do math very well, but at least we owed it to these kids to make sure when they left us they had developed some skill. Because I used to go out and see the teams every year, and I said, I hope you have a wonderful year. I hope you have a postseason experience. Good for you, good for us. But for goodness sakes, remember why you're really here. Because so few of you are going to make it to the pros, and so few are going to be there beyond 3 years. And even if you do make it, if you're not educated, some agent's going to dupe you out of all your money. And I'd also talk about their behavior, how they were role models, and how important it was for them to remember that they were privileged to be athletes in the Big Ten, to have that capability, and to be receiving a grant and aid. And that the quid pro quo was that they had to behave on and off the field in a fashion that brought credit to the university. And I said, it's no different than me. I said, you won't find me in a bar here in East Lansing. You won't find me doing things that bring discredit to this or embarrass this institution in any way, because it isn't me, it's the office that's important. And it isn't you, it's what you represent. And you represent this university and its athletic teams. And I would go through this litany with them every year. But I could see these third stringers looking at me and saying, oh, what's he know, you know? And then I would talk to the athletes, because I'd go in the locker rooms afterwards, and I'd talk to the athletes, and some of them would say to me at the end of the season, you know, I never wanted to be here, but how else was I going to make it to the pros? There was no other vehicle, you know. There was no other alternative, because there were no farm clubs for football or for basketball. That was it. Well, you know, I was close to sports. Travel with the teams, went into the locker rooms. Stan Drobeck, who was a tennis coach, a dear friend, and I used to go over and have bagels every Friday morning with George before the day before the game, you know. And we went to the Rose Bowl, and it was quite wonderful. Now I'm in Thailand, I think.
That's correct.
Yeah, and I get this call that it's a very critical, big issue. George is thinking about going to the Green Bay Packers, and you've got to talk to him. So I get on the phone with him, and I said, George, gee, I don't want you to do this. I mean, we love you at Michigan State, and things are great, you know, we're good friends. I said, but, you know, you've got to make a decision that's in the best interest of your family. I mean, you can't, you know, I can't, and I say this to anybody here, I mean, if people that get an opportunity for a better job, I say to them, you know, please, I mean, it's a tribute to us that other people want you, otherwise we wouldn't have anybody, right? So I said, you know, if you know, you'll have to make a decision on your own. Just know that I would love for you to stay. And I said, and I understand that, you know, we'll try to negotiate some things that would be helpful to you. Well, what we did negotiate was, I said, well, we'll give you a long-term contract to give you security. But in my absence, without consulting with me, the board also agreed to give him an annuity if he stayed so many years, and some other things that I hadn't even discussed. So I came back and was told all this. So I said, okay. I mean, I'm sorry you didn't think enough of to tell me, or at least discuss it with me, because you know, why should some people be getting things that others are not getting? That, you know, I got professors here I want to keep too. But you know, I swallowed it. And thought, well, that's it. You know, he's made his decision. He's going to be here now for his career. Well, lo and behold, two or three years pass. Doug Weaver comes in to see me one day and says, "I want to step aside as athletic director." And I said, "Gee, Doug, I wish you wouldn't do that. You know, you're still young. You know, and we got a lot of things to do here." Well, I want to step aside. This was like November, and I said, "Well, if you insist upon it, but please wait till after the season, after we've, you know, to announce it." Because I said, then, you know, we could get to discussing what we might do. And he said, all right, I won't discuss it with anybody else. That week is the football banquet. And I'm sitting next to George, and he says, well, Doug's leaving, and I want to be athletic director as well, just like Bo is over at Michigan. I was stunned. I said, please come in and talk to me about this. This is not the place to talk about it. So he came in to see me, and I said, well, George, to begin with, you know, I have some problem with a person serving in both roles because there's no checks and balances. I said, now, if you want to be athletic director and step out of the coaching, I mean, that's legitimate. I think that, you know, you could be a candidate and you'd probably be the prime candidate. I said, but you can't do both. He said, well, I'm talking to the New York Jets. Oh, no, that was that discussion. Then we get to the Aloha Bowl or whatever in Hawaii. Doug comes running and says, well, we got a real crisis. You know, the Jets are talking to George. I said, well, I thought we set this aside already. Well, you have to meet with him. So I meet with him. He says, are you going to make me athletic director and coach? I said, I told you, George. Number one, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. Number two, you know, we have affirmative action rules. We're supposed to go through a search, a legitimate search. And we go through a search, and you know, if you want to be athletic director, I think you'd probably be the candidate, but you can't be both. Some of the trustees meet with me and say, well, why not? I said, because, you know, we have rules to follow, and secondly, I said, it's not appropriate, I don't think, because this is an area where real mischief can occur. Well, look what happened in Michigan. I said, what happened in Michigan happened after they had gone through a search and two of them were aborted. And they did this, and Robin Fleming did it in an interim year, when he was president for an interim year. And I said, you know, we don't do what Michigan does. We do what we think is right. And they said, well, you know, we don't want to lose this guy. And I said, well, you know, I wanted to say to him, you know, we're not talking about Bear Bryant here, you know. So, you know, I let it go at that, thinking, well, you know, I'd made my point. Now we come back, and Larry Owen talks to me about this, and I said, Larry, I've told you how I feel, and according to your own bylaws, you cannot make an appointment without my recommendation. That's what the bylaws say. The only persons you can appoint are the president and the secretary without the approval of the president. Well, I can't understand why you feel. I said, well, because, you know, I'm a